Hello and welcome in.
First science. Because he shows them the magic and mystery of science in everyday living.
On Science Mixtape on Sofa Radio.
Hello and welcome to Science Mixtape with me, Kyle Major. I don't think it's an exaggeration to say the world is changing. We're living through a revolution in the way we communicate. The rise of social media and increased global connectivity is changing so much about the societies we live in. And nothing is this more obvious than the political sphere. From Donald Trump's trigger-happy Twitter obsession to Vote Leave's targeted Facebook ads, we're in a new era. With me today is an expert in all this new political communication and how political ideas spread and grow in the new world. Nick Anstead is a lecturer in political communication at the London School of Economics and hopefully can help us pick through the politics of the moment and tell us how new techniques are helping to develop a better understanding of the way ideas form and spread. Welcome, Nick.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
It's great to have you on. We're doing this remotely over Skype, which is new, so this should be great. And we also, in the studio, have Miriam.
Hello, Science Mixers.
We're gonna kick straight into a question for you, Nick, which is... Do you have a particular political persuasion, or do you try not to pick sides when you're doing this kind of thing?
Well, I suppose you're asking sort of a bigger question there, which is, you know, to what extent is political science a science? And I think it's complicated, right? Because we try and work with empirical facts and we try and work with data in the manner that, you know, most scientists would recognize. But also, I think the questions we are dealing with are inherently empirical. They're inherently also values-based as well. So, you know, we always bring our values with us. And, you know, we try and reach good judgments with the data we have. But I think it's also right that anyone who studies politics should have a vision about what politics should look like as well as what it does look like. And very often it's the tension between those two things that creates great work.
Well, yeah, brilliant. I mean, a lot of insight there, but I feel like maybe that was a little bit of a hedge. So he's not revealing anything about particular persuasion, but that's okay. We're going to jump straight in, Nick, with your first song. And this is Fleetwood Mac with Don't Stop. Why did you choose this one?
So I guess we're all kind of marked by our political memories. And I should say, I mean, maybe you're right accusing me of hedging on the previous answer, but I imagine in our time together, it might become quite obvious what my own views are. But this particular song, I remember it from 1992 when it was the campaign song for Bill Clinton's campaign. And I just about remember politicians before Clinton. But this guy came on and he had this music in the background and he was wearing sunglasses and playing the saxophone. And he just looked like something completely different. And it's the first time I ever remember people being really excited about politics.
Brilliant. Well, here, this is Fleetwood Mac with Don't Stop.
With computer-assisted text analysis, past or future conditions from message characteristics can be statistically predicted.
So yeah, Nick, you were talking about how maybe you're trying to get something that is both a, that's not really written down in numbers and study it in a scientific method. You look at the role of communication in politics and specifically like how elections are fought. Can you tell us some of the things that you look at?
Yeah, so I mean, over the years I've looked at a variety of things, but I guess the thing that runs consistently through my work is an interest in a clash between the old and the new. So in particular, what happens when you have something that's radically different, a new way of communicating, a new way of reaching voters, but when you drop that into a political system that's taken a long time to form and you have political institutions that have taken a long time to form, And what emerges out of the conflict potentially, or the tensions between those two things? Because quite often, I think what you find is something quite distinctive emerges, and it might be very different from, for example, country to country or party to party. So I suppose what I'm kind of pushing back on a little bit is this idea that technology has sort of innate characteristics or leads to innate outcomes, because I certainly don't think that's the case at all.
So it very much varies depending on, you know, what is being brought in and into what country or to what particular thing you're looking at. You're looking a bit at social media, right, and how that has affected them. Are there any kind of broad effects that you can discuss from something as broad as social media?
Yeah, my goodness, there are many, many effects. And I suppose one sort of health warning I would kind of give straight away is, certainly in popular discourse, the way in which we talk about those effects, or the effects we tend to spend most time thinking about, is quite shaped by fashion. So I completed my PhD in 2008. And at that time, everyone was very excited about the internet and Obama. And the argument was that what was going to happen was the internet was going to open up new ways for people to participate in democracy and new ways to be good and active citizens. So this was a wonderful thing at this point. You know, 10 years later, it's kind of, that has completely flipped round. And now everyone is very concerned about these technologies, how they're destroying democracy, how they're feeding populism. And what I would suggest is, you know, both of those things can actually be true at the same time, right? There can be tendencies to lead to things that are really quite destructive, like anger or polarization in politics. But there can also still, at the same time, be all the good things about civic engagement and educating people. So, you know, there are many, many effects. They probably all happen at the same time. Some of them are contradictory. And then in our popular discourse, we tend to focus on some of them at particular moments because it fits with a wider narrative. So unpicking this is really, really complicated.
Yeah, I mean, it definitely is. And can we put some parameters on what we're talking about? Like, when you say social media, what counts as social media?
Yeah, well, again, I think, I think clearly there is a sort of a technical definition we could give, which is, it's media which I think allow people to create their own content. It's media which allows people to interact with each other through that content, so maybe through rating it or sharing it or commenting on it. But I also think that there is sort of a fashion element to this as well, in the sense that over time, the types of media that people have meant when they've spoken of social media, what they've used that as a shorthand to mean, has changed.
Yeah.
So I think, again, in sort of about 2008, a lot of people talk about blogging. You don't hear much talk about blogging now, but maybe obviously the kind of the archetypal examples at this moment in time are sites like Facebook and Twitter, which, you know, at least in the first case, are also, you know, a very, very successful and powerful business. So it's not just a media platform with content, it's also a corporation that has profits and shareholders and things like that. But I suppose another sort of corrective I would make is to say, you know, don't just think about it either as a Western phenomenon. We know obviously a lot about Facebook, but there's an entirely different social media ecosystem, for example, in China, with different brands and different platforms that are structured in slightly different ways. They are certainly regulated in different ways. So there's all kinds of interesting things going on when we start to unpack that term of social media.
And is the can you say anything about the right now what the balance is between communication or political communication on social media and in the kind of more traditional forms of communication?
Yeah. So I mean, obviously, when we talk about an area I tend to write about, something like an election, then that's a very multifaceted communication environment anyway.
Yeah.
You know, we have candidates trying to communicate. We have voters trying to learn about the process. We have journalists writing coverage. So there's all these different things happening at once. And what we find is, in slightly different spheres, we've certainly seen an increase in the use of social media in recent years. Certainly some survey data now suggests that among some segments of the British and American electorate, for example, it is the most common way in which people get their news. But what I would sort of, I guess, say is those figures are important, but maybe what's more important are the sort of systematic changes it's bringing about. So when you look at, for example, something like election spending, what we're finding is there's this wholly new category of election spending, which now candidates and parties are engaging in. So, for example, spending significant sums of money on platforms like Facebook. You know, in the UK, in the last election, we had millions of pounds spent on Facebook. And that's really interesting, particularly in, say, the British context, because historically parties didn't have access to things like television advertising, like the previously dominant form of paid television advertising. Now they've got access to this new tool where they can send out highly targeted ads. So that changes the nature of our elections, potentially, really fundamentally.
Yeah, is social media kind of displacing older forms of communication, or is it different? Does one replace the other, or are we actually just seeing more? We're now seeing more channels opening up.
Well, I think so. Let's make a few observations about this. I think it depends who you want to talk to. I think that's the first thing. So I think for some sections of the electorate, it's a really, really good way to reach them. Maybe less so for others. I think it also depends on the institutional context in which it arrives in. So in the case of the United States, there's obviously a lot of television advertising, and television advertising is still very important. But obviously in a country like Britain, then you don't have television advertising previously. So in that sense, it's not a case of displacement. It's a place of, okay, you maybe had billboard advertising before, but essentially having that sort of direct electronic contact through paid advertising is a very new thing. I guess the final sort of thing I'd say is I wouldn't necessarily wholly think of it as displacement either. So sometimes these things work together and they work in synthesis. So, I mean, let me give you a sort of slightly, I guess, quite an obvious example, which is we hear a lot about Facebook adverts that are maybe targeted at getting people to vote, but there are also Facebook adverts that are targeted at getting people to go out and do other things like donate money or go and volunteer for a political party and go and knock on doors or engage in telephone canvassing. And so that sort of advertising is not about replacing previous modes of communication, but it's actually about enhancing them and getting the kind of resources you actually need to engage in them. So we shouldn't just see it as an either or. Sometimes these things feed in together to create a new synthesis.
Yeah, so it's not a complete, you know, we may still have slogans on buses and things like that, you know, going forward.
Absolutely, absolutely.
Brilliant. So we're going to move on to your next song, and this is David Bowie with Life on Mars. Did you choose this for a particular reason?
Yeah, so I mean, like lots of people, I love Bowie's music and he's a genius. But one of the things that really struck me when I went to the amazing exhibition they did at Victoria and Albert of his all kinds of aspects of his life a few years ago was how much work he put into being creative and how he developed strategies to be creative. And I think quite often academics as a group are guilty of groupthink. You know, we tend to think of things in a particular way, or collectively we move in a particular way. And actually we've seen that in recent years. I think the political science has been quite shocked by some of the things that have happened in our societies and things they hadn't expected to happen. So I think, you know, Bowie as a creator is a really powerful lesson.
Brilliant. Well, so here's David Bowie with Life on Mars.
It's a god-awful small affair to the girl with the mousy hair, but her mummy is yelling no, and her daddy has told her to go, but her friend is nowhere to be seen. Now she walks through her sunken dream to the seats with the clearest view,
analysis of media coverage from the 2010 UK general election demonstrated that social media is now being equated with public opinion by political journalists. Scientists use interviews with pollsters, social media researchers, and journalists to examine the perceived link between social media and public opinion.
Yeah, so we're just chatting about that, about how actually they're kind of on the same level, but maybe we shouldn't talk about displacement, or there's something else there. Nick, we've just recently heard that this is the end of austerity. And you've done some work looking into that concept in British politics. What did you do to investigate it?
So this was a big text-based study, and something that, or the nucleus of the idea was, where does a concept come from? Where does something that an idea that, well, we might have read about in our history books, you know, we might have learned about the 1950s or something like that, where people talk about austerity. But then where does it actually emerge from to become so central? And in order to try and understand this, I did a big text study of publications by think tanks published over about 10 years, running from before the banking crash in 2007-08, and then up until, I think, about 2013. Mm-hmm. And the idea was to try and track the use of this term austerity, but also to see what other concepts it was linked to. And the major finding of this was actually how little economic theory among, you know, think tanks, which we would expect to have a fairly high-level discourse in terms of these ideas,
yeah,
but how little economic theory was actually alluded to. Really, it came down to actually much more traditional ideological concerns. So right-wing think tanks tended to talk a lot about the European Union, right, and law and order when they spoke about austerity. These were actually the concepts they were linking it to. Whereas the left-wing think tanks tried to redefine the nature of the crisis. So instead of it being a banking crisis with a response of austerity, they actually tried to define it as a crisis created by austerity.
Right. Okay.
So there were these two different discourses, and you could sort of track them emerging over time and becoming established. And it was sort of the first time I tried to use these methods using sort of a big text analysis. Mm. But it was absolutely fascinating to sort of play with some of these amazing tools that are out there now. And you could literally watch these ideas solidifying over time. So it was a really instructive exercise for me. And I'm going to try and do some more of it in the future, I think.
So is this just looking at the frequency of words, or are you able to look at kind of the context to give you a bit better insight?
Yeah, so I think something that's important to me as a researcher, so my background is really in qualitative research rather than quantitative research, although I appreciate the power of systemizing those sorts of data sets in a quantitative way.
Mm.
But I think as a qualitative researcher, you can never quite escape that desire to read the data as well. And I think it's really important you do actually read it, because context does matter. Words are used in different ways, and to sort of answer your question more precisely, there was some stuff on word frequencies on there, but really what I was interested in was what are called co-locations of words. So that's where words appear together,
right?
So for example, yeah, on the right there was quite a preponderance to link, for example, austerity to police and crime. These quite often appeared in the same paragraphs together. You know, and I think that tells us something about ideology and ideas and how they link together.
Yeah, and to what extent were you able to kind of put that into the advances in natural language processing? Because you can look at distances between words, but maybe it's in a different, slightly different context. Were you limited by what we can do to actually make a computer, you know, understand the spoken word in as much as it can?
Well, to be clear, I wasn't doing natural language processing. I mean, this was more a kind of it's about, yeah, understanding the relationships between words and then sometime maybe graphically representing that with a technique like a correspondence analysis, which shows you the relationship between words on an axis. And there are people I know who do wonderful things with natural language processing, and it's such a huge advance in terms of what we can do. But all those people doing that work are very aware of the challenges. And I mean, I think there's been, it's fair to say in recent years, there's been a lot of work, for example, on Twitter data using NLP. But one of the things that anyone who's spent more than a few minutes on Twitter will know is that people on Twitter are quite often really sarcastic.
Yeah.
Or they're being humorous. And this creates all kinds of problems for NLP technology. I do think that human reading element is always going to be important, or at least in terms of any future that I can foresee in the medium term, at least.
Good. So you said you've also been looking at ways to measure public opinion. Does that mean that the standard telephone poll of how people are going to vote is dead or dying?
I mean, there's a whole debate on telephone polls and their validity and things like their response rates.
Yeah.
You know, we've got massively declining response rates. We know we've got, you know, many, many more people in mobile only households. We also have a big rival in the form of internet panel surveys, which are relatively very cheap. There's a debate about whether they're as accurate, but in an age where pretty much any form of opinion polling is subject to critiques as to its accuracy, certainly because of, you know, certain very, very high profile failures. Interesting just to say that there are studies which suggest the polls aren't actually getting any less accurate over time.
Right.
But you know, clearly high profile failures are not going to help the polling industry.
Yeah.
So there is a question about the real value of these techniques and also, you know, who's going to invest in them. A newspaper's going to keep paying for them, for example. But the work I did, and I did this with my co-author, Ben O'Loughlin, we looked at the emergence of a discourse of public opinion measurement around particularly social media data. And when people, you know, say, oh, a million tweets, 32% of them were positive about this politician, for example, and they start to kind of quantify these sorts of metrics. And we did a study where we actually interviewed the people doing this work and the opinion pollsters, the more traditional opinion pollsters. And what we found was, I guess, quite predictably, the traditional opinion pollsters didn't like it for the very accurate reason that social media data is non-representative.
Yeah.
You don't even really know what it's representative of, because you don't even really know what the universe of people using these spaces looks like. It's very hard, for example, to separate human beings from bots.
Yeah. I mean, the anonymity thing is obviously a problem there.
Yeah, exactly. Right. So and that's a problem. Right. Is this a real person? What if they live abroad? Right. What if they don't have a vote? You know, all these kind of questions. But what we kind of said, well, our response to this was, when we looked at it and we looked at the claims being made and looked at the interviews, was, well, the issue here is partially methodological, absolutely, right? You know, can we take social media data and construct a representative sample?
Yeah.
But a different way of looking at this is, it's also theoretical. In other words, what do we think public opinion actually is? And the history of this is kind of quite well known, I guess, but it really, our contemporary definition of public opinion emerges in the 1930s. And it emerges with the development of the representative sample opinion poll, particularly by people like George Gallup, create this. And therefore, it's the methodology that's actually created the definition.
Brilliant. So we're going to move on to your next song, which I think in public opinion is a great song. This is Blur with Pop Scene. Why this one?
So aside from the very obvious reason, I was always a Blur rather than Oasis. I don't know what other people were, but I was always a Blur boy. But I think I had the privilege of growing up with this sort of music, but I also think it kind of symbolizes the 1990s, and what I have only realized as I've got older is quite how shaped one is by the period you grow up in. So yeah, I suppose I have to admit that I am a child in the 1990s much more than I realized.
Well, here it is, and this is Blur with Pop Scene.
We'll be right back.
Human coding of data regarding news media is where trained coders read or look through selected samples of media coverage and systematically note its important traits.
So, Nick, it's good that we've had you on right now, because these ideas that you're exploring are clearly relevant to elections, and one of those is just about to happen in the US. And how is this election different because of the new ways that we're communicating?
Yeah, so I mean, I think, well, this particular election, we certainly can't separate from the political context in which it's occurring, right? Which is, it is very much being framed, interestingly, to some extent, by both sides, as a referendum on what happened in 2016. So Donald Trump's presidency.
Yeah.
And so clearly there's a big political context and, you know, potentially huge ramifications as well. If the Democrats do very well and take control of the House or the Senate, then that changes the political landscape for the next 2 years as well, very dramatically too. But I think in terms of specifically the modes of communication, I think we are seeing, I suspect when we look at the returns, the financial returns from the election, we will see there's been much more spending on new types of communication, so particularly obviously Facebook ads. But I suppose the other thing that is very present in the conversation and in people's minds are the fairness and security of those practices. And obviously there was a huge amount of talk in 2016 about interventions from outside actors, particularly Russian actors. There's also a whole question about the unregulated campaign finance space. So what are groups that are not the campaigns themselves doing, and what are they saying, and what does that do to the nature of democratic debate? And there's going to be a spotlight on that in a way that there just hasn't been previously.
Yeah, so recently Facebook said that it tried to make its ads more transparent. It says who pays for them and how much money they spend on paying for them. Do you think this is going to be a difference? Is this a move in the right direction?
Well, it's clearly a move in the right direction, because I think one of the major problems with these sorts of political communication is that they're basically completely private, right? You can't broadcast an ad on the television and not have it be seen or in some way enter into the public consciousness. It's a much more secretive space what people are seeing on their Facebook feed. You know, there isn't necessarily a clear archive of what's happening there. So I think, you know, any steps towards archiving and transparency are really, really good. And also just to put a plea in for the, you know, the academics, right? Because we I think do make a contribution to debates around these types of issues, but if we can't get the data, we can't actually do the research. And I think one of the interesting things about this whole discussion about Facebook ads in the past few months has been actually how little empirical base there has been to it, because the data isn't actually out there and available for people to do research on. But that being said, you know, have things gone far enough? No, I don't think they have. And I certainly feel a little bit uncomfortable with. So it's great that Facebook are putting these adverts out there and being more transparent. But I feel quite uncomfortable with that power being given to Facebook to do that. That it's Facebook that has decided to do this. My view is this should be something we as a society should decide and then act through statute and through the appropriate regulators. It shouldn't be down to the whim of a corporation as to the level of transparency we have in this space.
Yeah, so we do need some legislation on this. And in fact, the Vote Leave campaign, right, overspent on social media because it was able to do it through a hole and because it is this new form of communication. Do you think that legislation is ever going to be able to really crack down on that?
Well, I think the particular circumstances there were a combination of factors that led to that situation. So the first thing is referendum campaigns are in themselves a sort of disastrous political environment because there's very little incentive for the campaigns to behave well.
Yeah.
Because they don't have a legacy existence like a political party. So if a political party gets caught out cheating, it's not unlikely they're going to get punished at the next election.
Mm-hmm.
That doesn't necessarily happen in the same way with a dissolvable referendum campaign.
Yeah.
But then the other thing, as you kind of allude to in your question, is the nature of this advertising, right? You could easily spend hundreds of thousands of pounds in a few hours.
Right.
And indeed, the evidence we have suggests that Facebook advertising in those last few hours before an election is potentially more effective than advertising purchased earlier in a cycle. So there's a kind of a rational, logical reason to spend this money at the last minute, and you have the capability to do it. So I think there needs to be a few things that have to be said about this. So the first thing is, if we ever have another referendum in this country, we need to seriously think how referendums are regulated.
Yeah.
The second thing is, more generally, we need a serious rethink about how we regulate election spending generally. So one interesting challenge with, say, Facebook ads is, in the UK, we actually have two sets of campaign finance law. We have one at the national level and one at the local level, and they have distinct spending limits. But if, for example, a national party is targeting adverts at a particular constituency because it's marginal, which budget should we count that against?
Yeah.
So there's all these kind of questions that have never really been addressed. And there's a reason for this. And the reason for this is that passing any kind of campaign finance legislation is fiendishly difficult.
Right.
It's sort of radioactive to try and do this. Ultimately, because the people who are trying to pass the regulation are also the same people who benefited from the previous regulatory system. So it's a bit like asking, you know, politicians to regulate themselves after they've benefited from the arrangements that already exist.
And we know that doesn't tend to go very well, does it?
Well, it's a very big, you know, and politicians are rational, and there are also many, many other things that the public want them to do and will list more highly than campaign finance reform. But it's one of those things you only really notice it when it goes wrong, right?
Yeah.
So when it's working smoothly, or even if there are problems, but it's working reasonably smoothly, it's nowhere near the top of agenda. But when it goes horribly, horribly wrong, it becomes an issue of seismic importance.
Well, we're going to jump straight into the next song, which is Jimmy Cliff, and it's You Can Get It If You Really Want. So here it is.
You can get it if you really want. You can get it if you really want. You can get it if you really want. But you must try, try and try, try and try. You'll succeed at last. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Persecution, you must fear.
Social network analysis involves mapping the relationships that connect a certain community as a network, and then trying to draw out key individuals, groups within that network, and or associations between the individuals.
So here we go, we're diving straight into science news. Miriam, what do you have for us today?
So, as of last week, the last protons were accelerated at CERN up until 2021, where they'll be accelerated again. So a full renovation at CERN will occur from December 10th, but that doesn't mean that it's the end of science for CERN this year. So currently, lead ions are being accelerated and allowed to collide to help scientists find more about what existed in the early universe. So quark gluon plasma is something that the scientists are looking into, and it's thought to be existed in the first few millionths of a second after the Big Bang. So during this two-year shutdown, CERN will be preparing for a huge upgrade called High Luminosity Large Hadron Collider. So that's what we're going to be looking forward to in the next few years, and exciting science will happen after that.
Cool. I like this. This is just such a great experiment. I love the LHC. It's so massive. So I learned this stuff about using free space laser telecommunication through fog. Now this sounds really sci-fi. So what this is there are various different ways of communicating with lasers, and a good way to actually communicate between Earth and satellites for quantum communication, like the next level of doing this kind of thing, can do it optically with lasers. The problem is it doesn't work when it's cloudy, which is kind of annoying. So they developed this laser that they use. It's these high intensity short pulses that they fire through the cloud, and what it does is it creates laser filaments, and these optomechanically, so meaning like the heating and the drives the water out of the way, and it creates a little tiny, like 100 micron wide channel through the cloud, so they can then send the other laser in immediately after it. So this is like burning a hole in the cloud with one laser.
That's
so that they can communicate
cool.
with the other laser. It is like really sci-fi stuff, which is really great. And Nick, you've got something for us. What do you have today?
One story that really interested me was the comments that George Osborne made the other day about he admitted that they got things wrong in the run up to the European Union vote, the referendum in 2016. And something that he was quite specific about was he didn't think they'd articulated a positive enough case for European Union membership. And this kind of got me thinking about something that I think is a very interesting area in political science. And it's very interesting, obviously, because you've just kind of spoken about some quite sort of hard science stories, I suppose.
Yeah.
But actually, one of the big contentions in political science is still we don't really know with much certainty why people vote the way they do.
Right.
And there are various theories out there about this. And certainly in something as complex as a referendum, where you're asking people a single question, the many, many reasons people actually give for how they arrive at answering that makes it really, really complicated to unpick that. But I something that's very interesting in the context of many of the things that have happened recently, the EU or Brexit, is this big division between academics who think it's about economics. It's about whether people are richer or poorer.
Mm.
Or people who think it's about culture. And there's quite a big sort of division and a debate about the role that those two factors play or how they might interact with each other. I was very interested to see Osborne actually sort of taking that view that maybe had they made a more positive case for the EU. But another question that comes is, well, how do you make a more positive case after nearly 40 years of negative reporting and media coverage? And I think, you know, there's a very interesting question for academics there about the long-term effects, that sort of drip effect of the negative.
I think it's kind of amazing that he admitted that they got things wrong, which is something that politicians very rarely do. So something else I read was about sunbathing and how you shouldn't sunbathe every day. And so this was a study that was published in Molecular Cell on 25th of October. And what they did is Carmet Levy from Tel Aviv University and her colleagues illuminated mice either in like 24-hour, 48 or 72-hour cycles for 60 days. And they found that actually the mice that they exposed to the 48-hour schedule developed darker skin and had less DNA damage than the mice in the other groups. And so they then did the same thing with human skin cells and said that if you do it every other day, it actually makes more melanin than it does if they're radiated every day.
Oh, my gosh. I love light sunbathing, so I'm going to take that.
Yeah, so
thanks,
you have a break. Yeah, obviously, you know, be safe in the sun and wear sunscreen and all that. Nick, you've got something else for us as well.
Yeah, so, I mean, something that interested me is this report about wildlife loss. So we've seen that there's potentially a mass wildlife loss caused by human consumption. And something that, again, strikes me, the political scientist in me, is how do politicians actually cope with these sorts of policy problems, right? Because these are incredibly multifaceted, complex policy problems. But at the root cause of it as well is a sort of a communication issue. And I guess this also cuts across into things like global warming as well. But how do politicians even go about attempting to communicate to the public that their lifestyles have to change?
Yeah.
And sort of assumptions we have made for decades and things we've taken for granted, like air travel getting cheaper and cheaper, that these things are going to have to change. And something, an argument that's being made is that our systems, particularly, you know, where you have elections every 4 or 5 years, you know, are not very good at coping with these sorts of challenges, which might run out over a number of decades.
Yeah.
And again, so what kind of political institutions do you need to create and generate the policy responses that can actually deal with these kind of very long term but incredibly serious challenges?
Yeah, and they're incredibly complicated as well. And getting people up to speed, you know, you're talking to people from all different starting points. It's a big challenge. But we move on to your fifth song, which is not a song. This is actually Kennedy's first inaugural speech. is this, it, we're going to try and play the whole thing. We might not be able to fit it all in. Is there a particular, you know, message that you've taken from this?
Yeah, so I think, I mean, inauguration speeches are very significant moments in American politics. They're very symbolic. And I think, obviously, Donald Trump's speech has become infamous, the American Carnage speech, as it's called, because it offered a particular representation of what America and by extension, modern Western societies look like. Mm. And but what was also, I think, difficult about the Trump speech was it didn't have a vision about why America's interest is a global interest. Yeah. And so in the sense that there's a shared set of values that go beyond America, right? This was very much an isolationist speech, a nationalist speech. Whereas what Kennedy does so well is, and obviously one could look at the history of the Cold War and see hypocrisies there. And, you know, America did lots of things that are not, you know, morally defensible at that point. But yet there was still an intellectual vision that united America's purpose with a greater idea about making the world better. And also the way Kennedy articulates it is also just a reminder that politics can be a force for good as well as a force for destruction.
Oh, brilliant. Here it is.
Let the word go forth from this time and place to friend and foe alike that the torch has been passed to a new generation of Americans born in this century, tempered by war, disciplined by a hard and bitter peace, proud of our ancient heritage, and unwilling to witness or permit the slow undoing of those human rights to which this nation has always been committed and to which we are committed today at home and around the world. To those people in the huts and villages of half the globe struggling to break the bonds of mass misery, we pledge our best efforts to help them help themselves. For whatever period is required, not because the communists may be doing it, not because we seek their votes, but because it is right. If a free society cannot help the many who are poor, it cannot save the few who are rich. In the long history of the world, only a few generations have been granted the role of defending freedom in its hour of maximum danger. I do not shrink from this responsibility. I welcome it. I do not believe that any of us would exchange places with any other people or any other generation. The energy, the faith, the devotion which we bring to this endeavor will light our country and all who serve it. And the glow from that fire can truly light the world. And so, my fellow Americans, ask not what your country can do for you. Ask what you can do for your country. My fellow citizens of the world, ask not what America will do for you, but what together we can do for the freedom of man.
A think tank is a research institute, an organization that performs research on topics like social policy or political strategy. Think tanks are often analyzed by researchers to work out trends between different variables.
So a lot of stuff you do is with looking at these think tanks. But let's look more generally. How has social media changed over your career, really?
Well, I think, as I sort of said to you earlier, what we consider social media has evolved. When I first started thinking about the internet, you know, people meant message boards by social media.
Yeah.
You then had blogging. You then had companies like Twitter and Facebook as sort of plucky little upstarts. Those of you who were on Twitter very early will remember the fail whale. Right, this was a screen that popped up when their servers fell over because they hadn't invested enough money in having good servers. And then on to the case where, you know, there's some of the most powerful companies in the world. So there's been, and I think there's also been a parallel move in terms of political communication. So when I first started writing about this and researching it, the internet people were kind of these random individuals who didn't have much to do with the rest of the campaign. They kind of sat in the corner of the room and all the important decisions were taken somewhere else. And they didn't have much money. That's the other thing. But now you have the experts in this field are right at the top table of political campaigns. They're right at the center of designing the strategy. They are, you know, in these positions of significant authority in terms of how campaigns are actually run. So things have changed a lot.
And this communication has transformed over the last few decades. And do you think that maybe this is a sign that there needs to be a bit of a rethink on how the communications orchestrated? You were talking before about legislation, but so there was a move recently. The British Library did this modern Magna Carta in the internet, where they tried to see what were the things that they wanted to encapsulate that would enable people to communicate more easily or in a safer way. Do you think that something like that is needed, or do you think that this is something that will be slowly accommodated into the way that political discourse happens?
Well, I don't think those two things are mutually exclusive. I think as a society, we need to have a conversation and find a way of having a conversation about the types of changes that are happening and how we want to manage those changes.
Yeah.
So, that may be, for example, that we want to think about in the UK context, do we want paid advertising on social media? Or do we actually want to say, no, that's not something we want, as we did with broadcast media in the past?
Yeah.
And, you know, we need to have that conversation because at the moment we're not really doing it. We also need this takes us right back to your very first question, but we also need the evidence to arrive at informed value judgments. So it's all very well saying what we'd like, but the question is, do we actually know enough about these platforms and how they work and what they do and the effects they have to instigate those values through legislation and regulators and such like? But I also think society is very robust. Society evolves, society will adapt, society will change, right? There are so many changes happening at the moment, not just in the political. And so, you know, our economies are changing, our expectations as consumers are changing, the way we gather information we need to live our daily lives are changing, the way we exist in formal educational institutions like universities and schools is changing. So all these things are happening at once, and we will achieve new equilibriums, but that, you know, as always when very, very radical changes happen, there will be some difficult transitions as well.
Well, brilliant. Thank you so much, Nick. How can people find out a little bit more about you and what you do?
Yeah, so probably the best thing to do is follow me on Twitter, which is at Nick Anstead. But you could also find lots of my work, and lots of it is open access as well, on the LSE website.
Brilliant. Thank you very much. That is all from us here at Science Mixtape. Don't forget to share this program if you liked it. If you didn't like it, keep it to yourself. We can be found at Science Mixtape on all the evil social media channels. Follow us, and hopefully we can lead you astray politically. Producing this week was Miriam. I've been Kyle, and our guest was Nick Anstead. Thanks again, Nick.
My pleasure.
And we're going to finish off with your last song, which is Labby Siffre, It Must Be Love. So here we go. Thank you and goodbye.
I do. And I never thought I'd feel this way.